Hi, welcome back to Books and Broomsticks. I'm Chaotic Witchaunt.
And I'm Matt Hatter Plays.
And today we have a very special guest with us, Jew Witches. Hi, Jew Witches.
Hello.
What are we talking about today?
Today we're going to be talking all about Jewish folk magic.
I am so excited. And before we start, is there a place where everyone can find you? Do you have a social media, a website, etc.?
Yes. Thank you so much for having me. You can find me on my website, jewwitches.com. You can find me at Instagram and TikTok, also at jewwitches. You can find me on Twitter and Tumblr at thejewwitches. I think that's all the social media.
I think that's it too. I don't know any past that.
YouTube. Hold on, maybe? I'm looking.
We
actually do have a YouTube channel, but there's nothing on there. It is just Jewitches. Maybe there will be there one day, but it's just Jewitches.
Mood. I'm actually really excited about this particular episode because when we've done regional folk practices, a lot of times it's very niche, like regions. Mm-hmm. Jewish folk magic doesn't fit under that category, though. Mostly, obviously, the running gag is that you've been kicked out of everywhere, so you're everywhere.
Yes.
But there is a certain kind of rule, though, in particular, that it's not just your folk magic is everywhere. It's also the religion that's directly impacting that magic, right?
Yes. Jewish folk magic is the folk practices that are associated with the Jewish ethno-religious group of the Jews, which is the nationhood, the peoplehood of Jews. The term religion is like an ill-fitting sweater that Judaism wears. Judaism predates the concept of religion, which is very much created to fit the concept that was created by Christianity. And therefore, Judaism wears it because of identification reasons, for scholarship, that it doesn't really fit, but because of the purpose of scholarship and academia and societal understanding, it's what's used. But it's never going to fit properly, which is why we are an ethno-religious group. And like you said, Jews are a global people because of the diaspora. Despite originating in one place, the Jews have moved throughout the globe in diasporic groups. So there are regional aspects through different diasporic groups as we have moved about the globe. And even within one diasporic group, so say Ashkenazi Jews, which is a group of Jews that moved and settled first along the Rhine River, and then spread out. So for example, some Jews stayed in certain areas of Germany. So there's Swabian Jews, Jews who moved to France, to Ukraine, Russia, North even Jews who went to England and then were kicked out and then went back. There's many different groups. And so even within the Ashkenazi Jewish diaspora, there are many different regional differences within that folk magic, within that folk diaspora. And there are many different diasporic groups. So the folk magic relates directly to the religious aspect of our ethno-religious group. And the religious aspect is within each group. So even though there may be variations throughout the group, the magic, throughout each group, the religious aspects connect each and every single one. And there are obviously folk practices that are very, very similar or even exactly the same between different diaspora groups, even though they may be on completely different areas of the globe. They are very, very similar and very much the same because they are all connected by this single thread of these religious practices, these religious beliefs, these religious texts, and these single beliefs, if that's clear.
That was wonderful. I love hearing you talk. That's just me, though. This is what every podcast guest, I hear tangents and I'm like, keep going, please.
Yeah, we've got really great guests with great voices. And then you have Frankie and I who were just doing our best.
Stop.
We sound a little like trolls sometimes.
I am certainly, I fit under like troll category.
I would say
like,
gnome for me. I'm a gnome.
Yeah, that's why Matt, you freak me out sometimes.
Matt hates me sometimes.
A Okay, yes, there is a whole thing to anybody who's ever wondered. I have a natural hatred against garden gnomes.
Okay. All right.
They're just...
Just garden gnomes?
Yeah.
So any other kind of gnome is fine?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay, does it have to be any specific kind, or any gnome in any garden gnome is just off limits?
When I paint it in my head, it's the one with the red caps.
Okay, which I know the white beard.
Yeah, which I know is very much like an alchemical type of thing and a folklore thing. But no, I just hate those ones. Okay. I don't know. Like, I used to have to, like, shift them at my grandma's house, like, when I was coming over. I was like...
Would the color of the hat change anything?
No.
Valid. Okay.
Different type of hat. It's the one that's painted. Yeah, it's the one painted in my head is that particular one. I don't know. You stick a gnome in a garden.
I'm waiting for Dewitches to pull out a garden gnome. That's what
I don't have any garden gnomes, but I can picture one. I can picture one so perfectly in my head.
And
that
it's
like
cap,
there's one right here. Red cap, white beard. They're usually wearing like overalls.
The trousers.
They're
wearing
the
like
one.
Wellington boots.
Yeah,
sometimes they have like a... Yeah. Like Gnomeo and Juliet must be your favorite animated film.
Gnomeo and Juliet was a disaster to begin with.
I don't know how it even got... I don't know how any studio said
that,
this was okay.
That's a curse on this land.
Literally the second they did that, I was like, that's a hate crime. That's anti-Indigenous. Like,
I don't understand how they made two. Didn't they make two of them?
Yeah, they did. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. Yeah. Now I'm vaguely remembering something. Wasn't there at one point? Oh God, there was something where you're working on one film at the Disney studio, and if you did badly on it, you got sent to work on another film that was really bad.
I think it was Shrek, actually, that people had to work on.
First of all, Shrek is Jewish. I hope you know this.
But it's also great, so, like...
Shrek, I'm telling the people this, in case people don't know, Shrek comes from Yiddish. Shrek is to scare or to terrify. Shrek was written by a Jew, the original book, the original story. Shrek is a Jewish legend, one of my favorite films. And if anyone hates Shrek, I will make accusations.
I literally quoted Shrek today in our other episode.
Yeah, Shrek is fantastic. But I think Gnomeo and Juliet must have been like, what happens if you mess up on Shrek? I know they're completely different time.
Yeah, no, I agree with you.
But if you messed up on that, you had to work on Gnomeo and Juliet and that atrocity.
The funny thing is like, if you did badly, you ended up on the Shrek storyboard. Mm-hmm. Imagine being so shit that they kicked you off of that storyboard and ended up in another movie. You're correct. It's Gnomeo and Juliet. There's no way otherwise.
We have to stop this conversation because I'm not going to be able to breathe in 5 minutes. We gotta scoot back to the outline.
No, this is all about hating on gnomes now.
Oh, no. To add on from Jewish religion and folk magic, you mentioned Jewish folk magic being everywhere, but also the diasporic traditions. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like Jewish folk magic as a whole is very different from very select regional folk magics? And how is it similar?
I think that oftentimes when we think of folk magic, I think there are a lot of similarities, right? And when we have the idea of folk magic, usually we have an idea of a normative practice and then a non-normative practice. And if we think of a folk magic that is associated with, say, Catholicism, there is the official practices that are approved of and perpetuated by the church that is headed up by the Pope, right?
And non-canonical.
Exactly. Judaism functions differently. Once the temple, the Beit HaMikdash, was destroyed, there no longer was a single rabbinic authority, and Judaism had to function very differently in the diaspora. There is no single authority within Judaism. We don't have a single head of the Jewish religion, like in Catholicism, which is a big misconception that people have. They often try and point to groups that are heavily recognized by many Jews, because there are rabbinical councils that many Jews recognize. There are rabbinical rulings that many Jews recognize, but these are not universal, because there is no universal leader. And there is no single one ruling that every single Jew agrees upon simply by being Jewish. And so when we talk about normative and non-normative practices, we do have to look at what is normative for each community. And these communities vary by diasporic group and by diasporic community within that group. So for example, if we're going to talk about, say, a community that was in Morocco, a Jewish community in Morocco may have a very different perspective on something, what is normative within their community, looking at their leader, as opposed to a community that is across the ocean in Spain. And that could be very different to a Jewish community in Hungary. And even if these leaders of those communities were to come together and discuss, they could each come to their own different rabbinic rulings. And that is something that is very, very common. Discussion and disagreement within Jewish communities is highly prized and highly valued. One of our most central texts, the Talmud, is it's very commonly described as a Reddit thread of rabbis. It is an argument. I'll read to you if you'd like to hear something that I think is rather brutal.
Right
one
now,
of
yes.
My, yes. One of my favorite quotes from the Talmud, it says, Rabbi Elias said to him, "May the merciful one save us from the following this opinion, as your argument is illogical." Rabbi Hanina replied, "On the contrary, may the merciful one save us from your opinion, as yours is the baseless opinion." And this is in the Talmud. This is the time, they're obviously a lot of the times they're a little bit more respectful, but this is the kind of argument that we very frequently see and we prize. Literally, this is arguing and trying to find basis and scholarly basis and academic basis for this within our own texts is very much valued.
My favorite part of that was, well, your argument's illogical. Your argument's stupid, so.
Yours is baseless, yeah. It's one of my favorite quotes. I have it screenshotted on my desktop because I think about it all the time. It's one of the first times I read it, I couldn't stop thinking about it. It's just...
So I would even say, just listening to that one quote from the Talmud, mm-hmm. It is so different from Christianity. And therefore, I know a lot of the Jewish practitioners that I've talked to do not like the label Judeo-Christian because it is so different.
I've actually written an article on this topic. Judeo-Christian is a fallacy. It's mm-hmm. a concept that was created. So there's different definitions to this term, but and people like to argue the former definition, which was the idea of Jews who were forced to become Christian, or Jews who, even by their own volition, became Christian. But that's not the modern definition, and this is a baseless argument to try and make that, oh, well, it was originally meant this. It's not what we're arguing. The idea of Judeo-Christian is to conflate and to synonymize Judaism with Christianity, which is to forcibly erase Judaism and to push Christian narratives, ideals, values, and belief systems onto Judaism. Jews make up a minuscule fraction of the world. Our beliefs are not well known. There is very little understanding and knowledge of what we believe. And much of what is known, is misinformation. And many Jews, myself included, do not expect people to know about Judaism. There is no illusion that people are gonna know a lot about Jews. We make up a tiny percentage of the world. There is roughly, large estimate, 15 million Jews in the world. The idea that we should be okay with the conflation and erasure of our beliefs with a religion that has continually attempted to enact genocide against us through cultural erasure and through violence is unacceptable. Judaism is not and has never been Christianity. Judaism does not believe the same things as Christianity. We do not have the same values. Mm-hmm. And the universal values that we have are not singular to the two of us.
Yeah.
The idea that murder is bad is not singular to
what?
Just Judaism and Christianity.
What?
I would also be really clear. A lot of the times, Judeo-Christian is used to be highly Islamophobic. It is used very often to try and marginalize Muslims, to try and marginalize and create a dichotomy of Jews and Christians over here as the quote-unquote good guys who believe in quote-unquote civility, and the evil, awful, horrible Muslims over here who don't believe in the quote-unquote good things, when that is simply untrue.
Not true.
And unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And
would you say that the term Abrahamic has a similar connotation to Judeo-Christian, or do you feel as though when people use that, they are trying to get at something different? Because I've heard people say Judeo-Christian, and I know from talking to you and talking to other Jewish practitioners that that's bad, and I know why that's bad. But Abrahamic, I've never had a conversation about that.
So Abrahamic is more accepted because generally, right, we don't have the same issue of necessarily excluding Islam. But when it comes to more generalizing terms like this, we run into the same problem of we're playing a numbers game. Whose practices and beliefs and morals, values are more well known in this game? When we say the Abrahamic belief of X, which one is the most well known?
Yeah.
When you say the Abrahamic belief in an eternal hell, does that even exist in Judaism? And the reality is there are roughly 15 Abrahamic religions. Which ones are being spoken about?
Yeah.
It's generally, I don't believe they're talking about the Baha'i faith.
They're about generally, Christianity.
Usually that's the case. And I've come to the conclusion that I do believe that there are appropriate times for this terminology. I do believe that there are appropriate times, but I also believe that when we have conversations regarding faith, religion, ethno-religious groups, values, morals, mythology, it is useful to be very hyper-specific in our terminology, because when we play this numbers game of whose religion is most well-known, there is going to be harm to marginalized groups, and highly stigmatized religions face greater repercussions. There is quite a bit of bigotry and stigma that is very often perpetuated through misinformation and through generalization. And generalizing through the use of Abrahamic, even with a good intention, is still harmful. And I often see witches and pagans do this without considering the ramifications of Islamophobia, without considering the ramifications of anti-Semitism, which is why my recommendation, which may be different than other Jews, I know that there are Jews who don't mind Abrahamic whatsoever, but my personal recommendation is list the religions you mean. Because if you mean Christianity, it's not that much longer to just say Christianity. And even if you mean to say Catholic, you can say Catholic, because you might not mean Protestant. You might just mean Catholic. If you're talking about the Pope,
and nobody means Lutheran.
If I'm talking about Martin Luther, which I frequently am, I am frequently talking about Martin Luther. I have a lot of strong opinions on Martin Luther.
I mean, yes,
none
you
of
should.
Them good.
That's
don't
fair.
Know who Martin Luther King?
No.
He's the man who nailed the
Martin
up.
Luther was the, he's responsible for the creation of Lutheranism. So anyone who knows who
the
Lutheran is
the
after
Lutherans.
Him. So he was a virulent anti-Semite, hated Jews so much. He nailed his list of demands to the door of the church. And he basically was like, I'm not doing this anymore.
Yeah, he
That's
was
my interpretation of it.
He was the mean girls of
Christianity,
basically.
He didn't believe. He was really upset with a lot of things in the church, but he also was. I speak a lot about anti-Semitism, so I'm going to go from this angle. He was really upset that Jews didn't like being forced to convert to Catholicism, and so he was like, "We're going to try and be nice to you." And then the Jews were like, "Okay, well, we still don't want to be Christian." And he's like, well, so we're going to try and kill you. And Jews were like, well, that wasn't good either. And he's like, okay, well, now we're going to try pogroms. So he like passed out. He wrote many, many, many things. But one of them was a leaflet or a pamphlet called The Jews and Their Lies. He wrote many things on, including pamphlets on like
Yeah, it's he's not a great Jews. He's not a great dude, especially when it comes to like anti-Semitism. He's one of the worst. And then when you look at Christian lenses, he's also one of the worst because he wanted to loosen the hold of some of the the church. He basically wanted the church less in the religion, but he also wanted them to force Jewish conversion. So he was basically a fuck all dude who had no idea what he was doing, but he just made a lot of demands, a lot of really shitty demands.
I'm sorry. The term I was looking for was the Protestant Reformation. He was responsible for the pioneers, one of the pioneers of the Protestant Reformation. I could not remember the R word in that one. It's the Reformation. There we go.
Yeah. Yes. So you ended up with two sects of people who followed his beliefs. The people of the loose Lutherans, which is how I was raised, who didn't really believe in any of the church shit, but we still showed up on Sundays. Then you had Protestants who were very much everybody, everything about the church needs to be rewritten and yada, yada, yada.
Have you seen Rinstar's like 30-second or maybe it's a minute long TikTok of church history?
Yeah.
Oh my god, Frankie, you have to watch it. Wait,
it's
let
really
me...
funny.
Just send it to me. I will watch it.
It was great.
I'm gonna hop around on this outline a little bit too, and I wanted to ask you what your favorite practice, superstition, and belief, all three within Jewish folk magic.
Well, so like I said, because Jewish folk magic is so much intertwined and inseparable from Judaism as a whole, much of this can be just classified as quote-unquote Judaism. Mm-hmm. And I do want to note that in this conversation, and you may get, I don't know how much many responses you get, but you might get mail about this, because of anti-Semitism, there is a great deal of fear in the way that we speak about our practices. There is a great deal of caution in the way we discuss our practices, and the use of the term magic in any way is very, very dangerous and has been dangerous for hundreds of years. So a lot of what is labeled as folk magic is often labeled as folk practice, folk medicine. And for example, the book A Frog Under the Tongue, this is a great, fantastic book. Many of the practices within it can absolutely be categorized under folk magic, but they are all labeled as folk medicine. A lot of practices are just labeled as superstition in order to protect us from harm. I can read a quote from Joshua Trachtenberg's Jewish Magic and Superstition that outlines why these things happen if you want, but I just like to make that note before.
Okay. Read it.
Give me your best librarian voice while you read it.
I can do elementary school teacher, but I don't think I can
yes,
do librarian.
Yes, I'm on it. I'm ready. I'll take it.
All right. So this is a story of, this is a discussion of how Jewish practices were forever altered by anti-Semitism and the fear of Jews as magicians and sorcerers within the Christian perspective within Europe specifically. But this idea spanned much of the Jewish world at that time. In Provence, however, the ritual cleansing of a public oven in preparation for Passover baking was neglected because of the Gentile suspicion of sorcery. When a fire broke out in a Jewish house, its owner dared expect little mercy from the mob, for he was a sorcerer seeking to destroy Christendom, and his punishment was commonly simultaneous with his crime. The rabbis of the time were therefore unusually tolerant about violations of the prohibition to put out fires on the Sabbath and on the Day of Atonement. At the slightest danger, they set this prohibition aside, for this is a matter of life and death, since they accuse us and persecute us. This is describing here is the practice of, at Passover, you cannot eat any leavened bread, so cleansing the ovens is incredibly important, but they stopped doing that publicly. Which is literally stopping one of the most important Jewish practices, because non-Jews would accuse us of sorcery and persecute us. And as this rabbi said, this is a matter of life and death, since they accuse us and persecute us. And within Judaism, there's a concept of pikuach nefesh, which is preserving a life. Nefesh translates to one of the many layers of the soul, and is the preservation of human life. And here we say we see that the rabbis were therefore taught when a house would catch on fire, the Christians would believe that it wasn't a tragedy, it wasn't something that they should help with, but it was rather Jews' magic going awry, or it was a sorcerer who was trying to destroy the town, just trying to destroy Christianity, and therefore it would be a crime, it would be something to persecute them against. So usually on Shabbat, on the Sabbath, you don't put out a fire. You're not supposed to touch a fire whatsoever. It's muksa. It's not to be touched on the Sabbath or on a holy day. The Day of Atonement is referring to Yom Kippur, which is one of the holiest, if not the holiest day within the Jewish year. But the rabbis here are talking about how there is a lot of lenience regarding putting these fires out, because again, even if you must break the law in order to do this, and the law within Judaism, because again, before we don't have the concept of religion, Judaism is meant to be a holistic, all-encompassing system of ethnicity, identity, and the law of Judaism is public law, communal law, and religious law. If you must break the law to protect yourself from persecution, you can do that because these are the things that would happen. So when we talk about, you know, folk magic, we talk about it in this cautious and careful way, and people still are very, very upset with the work that I do because they believe that the work that I do will cause anti-Semitism. And it's something that, frankly, I'm very afraid of. So when I say these things, I like to keep in mind the fact that I have to be very cautious with what I share publicly. And I have to put these things in very historical perspectives. So that is the little, and by little, I mean extremely long monologue I give before I answer your very simple question of what is my favorite practice, superstition, and belief. My favorite practice, I did write down two, but I'll start with my first one, which is just within Judaism, but exists within the folk magic realm as well, and that is the cleansing of with water. Judaism sees water, and specifically living waters, as one of the most fundamental aspects of cleanliness. And cleanliness is highly important. Within traditional Jewish life, cleanliness is, you know, they say cleanliness is next to godliness. It's vital. You can't not be clean.
Wash yourself.
You said it perfectly. Wash yourself, wash your hands, wash your body, be cleansed. In traditional Jewish life, you ritually wash yourself many, many times per day. Ritual washing is different than regular washing. You must also regularly wash yourself and wash yourself. In traditional Jewish life, you'd wash yourself before you even get out of bed. You wash your hands three times over usually a bowl that resides beside your bed before you get up. You wash your hands every single time you use the restroom before you eat, usually before certain prayers. And then we have something called the mikveh, which is a ritual bath. And the ritual bath must be of living water. So the very first thing when you do, when you create a Jewish community, when you create a place of Jewish life, is to build a mikveh, is to have access to running clear water. And so there are many Jewish magical practices, many folk practices that include the immersion in the mikveh. And I think that it's one of my favorite things because I think that it's such a powerful practice to use water in this manner, to use water as such a cleansing tool.
So I have a very adjacent question. Yeah. It's not on here, but I've always wanted to ask you, what is your favorite Jewish-based folklore creature?
Oh God, okay. I mean, there are a lot, right? There are so many Jewish creatures, and I think that, I don't know why I wasn't expecting this question. People always ask me, I'm really not very good at picking a favorite. I also wrote down two for this one. There's also so much variation in all of our creatures. Okay.
And no, you can't say Captain America.
He counts.
Not.
I'm saying you're
not allowed.
I mean, I wasn't going to, but you know what? I love the Cree.
Why is Captain America Jewish folklore?
You don't know?
Okay, so the reason that Captain America was created by two Jewish comic book creators. He was created during World War II. I'm a huge Marvel person. I don't know if many people actually know that, but I am. He was created at a time of immense anti-Semitism. A lot of people don't know that the United States was virulently and violently anti-Semitic. There was a rally of 50,000 American Nazis at Madison Square Garden in the United States. You can find photos of it online. The United States did not enter the war to save Jews, which is the narrative that is often presented nowadays. And so two Jewish American comic book creators created Captain America, and his very first ever comic book cover featured him punching out Hitler. And essentially what they were, and this is my understanding of it, was to create a all-American, these are in quotes, all-American superhero that people could look up to, who was there to defend Jews and who would show that Jews were not, who were worthy of defense, were not evil, harmful, dirty, being worthy of stigmatization, should not be turned away from our borders, as many, many, many Jews were. Essentially a quote-unquote goodwill ambassador towards Jews created by two American Jews to try and get the American public to be more sympathetic to the persecution and genocide of Jews during the Holocaust.
I love that. And,
which is why so many Jews, myself included, were so virulently upset by the creation of Hydra Cap.
It's Hitler Captain America. It's literally the opposite end of what he stands
I'm gonna
for
look that up while you answer your favorite folklore creature other than Captain America.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got all angry about Captain America. My favorite folklore creature, I'm gonna go with the vegetable man.
I gotta hear about the vegetable man.
Is it like the what's it called, the bakery man? What is it that, what is that childhood rhyme that's like, oh, gingerbread man?
Oh, no, it's not like the gingerbread man, but I was so interested because what you reminded me of is a practice from, I believe it's a Slavic practice that I've discussed, read about, where that includes, for feverish children, it includes, I don't have a citation for this, and it was discussed with an elderly practitioner, so I don't have any sort of citations other than word of mouth. Creating a very thick salt dough that it has quite a number of herbs in it and packing it onto the skin of a child that is very feverish and placing them close to the close to an open fire and then bakes on the skin. That would be super cool.
Up here in America too. Under Nebraska folk cures, there used to be like this poultice that was the exact same thing. You would apply it and then you would just like leave it and bake, like to bake basically. It's because it would draw the heat from the skin to make bread.
There's a German kid, it's a very old school children's book that is horrifying. It involves two kids being baked into food.
Delicious.
I mean, it's terrifying. The artistry in it is horrifying, but it reminds me of that. So vegetable men, I've done a podcast episode on them. They are a creature that has a very long umbilical cord that connects them to the earth, and they grow like vegetables connected to the ground. And if you sever the umbilical cord, they will die. Now, they are tethered to the earth, and therefore they cannot move outside of the radius from their cord or their stem, but they, unlike vegetables, are carnivorous, and therefore they will eat you if you get into their radius. It was believed or theorized that they were wiped out in the flood of Noah, in the great flood. But they are a very fun
That's
one.
My cool.
Secondary one that I will say will be a mud mouse. A mud mouse is a so the mud mouse comes from the idea of spontaneous generation, which was very was a scientific belief that has obviously since been debunked, but it is the idea that mice come from filth and they grow from the ground just as like filth literally like comes up from the earth, and so it's a mouse that is half made of earth and half made of flesh. So eventually it'll become entirely flesh, but for a small period of time, half of the mouse is an actual living, breathing mouse, and the other half of the mouse, usually from left to right, is made out of mud, and that's why there'll be like muddy little footprints around your house.
Yeah, I think I've heard you talk about the mud mouse before.
I've done a video on that one on TikTok.
I think it made me think about something that obviously it's probably me just being really dumb and not actually doing my own research. Mud is a really common life giver in Jewish folklore, it seems like, or at least a lot of the creatures seem to be either made of mud or originated from mud.
Yeah, so well, we have to look at the origins of Judaism. So Judaism originates in, you know, the Swana region, Southwest Asia. And so we look at the original mythology of the area. So say like Mesopotamian mythology, the mythology of, you know, Canaanite mythology. You see this, you know, it's called the Fertile Crescent, right? This mm-hmm. idea of mud being so prevalent. What are things made from? Where is the plentiful nature of the area? And within Judaism, mud played a very substantial role in the sense of life in that area. A lot of the clay was foundational to life. And so when we look at it actually giving life, we see Adam is formed from dust, but, you know, Lilith as well. Adam and Lilith are both formed from dust. And then we see the mud mouse, a spontaneous generation. The mud mouse does also exist, along with this, not as fully formed as far as I've been able to find in other mythologies. It's been really solidified within Jewish mythologies, just to the nature of Jews writing everything down and talking about things constantly. But it does exist to some extent in other mythologies because of the nature of Jewish assimilation. And we also see the golem being used, but we also see, and this is one of my favorite things, and I think I've spoken to you regarding this before, is incantation bowls and the use of incantation bowls or magic bowls. And that is the use of a clay, usually, bowl carved to contain or hold a demon, evil entity, but also other, you know, other vessels. I'm sorry, it can also serve other purposes as well. There are other things used, but
yeah, if I remember correctly, what I was watching and researching, it, usually there would be one kept under the house or in the foundation of the house in order to keep Lilith away, if I remember correctly.
We have, I can't list the practices to keep her away, okay? I'll say this. We do everything to just
red ribbon around a crib.
The red ribbon, coral, blubies, gold, silver, knives, swords.
You guys use coral too?
We do use coral.
We have coral. There is very big for Malocchio in Italy.
Coral is one of the biggest, is a very, it was specifically also for children, was another one. Fish as well. There's an amazing fish coral amulet that I just, I have a Patreon, the Jewish's Patreon, which you can subscribe to if you want. Every week we display a amulet or piece of art from a different Jewish collection around the world, with a direct link, obviously, and sourcing and accreditation directly to the museum, of course. And we recently displayed one of, or maybe it's coming up. I know I scheduled it, but it's an amazing coral fish-shaped amulet that I believe was specifically created for a child to protect them.
I love specifically. That. I have a coral hand rosary.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Took me forever to find red coral because right now it's so difficult.
Very rare. Yeah, it's very difficult.
I know that, like, we're going to have a future episode, assuming that you would want to come back, just talking about the Lilith situation, but not in that way. I more want to talk about her original faith and design, why we keep her away and things, because ultimately, Boss Babe Lilith is very new, and ultimately, she eats children and needs to be kept out of the house. So it's so strange to me.
She is an embodiment of
bad.
Perfectly stated. Yes, as always.
Matt, do you have a question? We both inhaled at the same time.
That actually never happened, so this is real weird. I don't.
Yeah. Whoa.
I think I got so weirded out. Well, I was gonna say.
I was just gonna go into our kind of final questions because I don't want to chat too much about Lilith in this episode because it's not the purpose of this episode, and I would prefer you to be in talk about like what you're comfortable with in terms of Lilith, but. Do you have to be Jewish to practice Jewish folk magic?
Yes.
Yep.
Any question regarding anything, do you have to be Jewish to do anything Jewish? The answer is,
yeah.
When it comes to Judaism, you must be Jewish to practice Judaism. Within Judaism, a Jewish person can invite you to participate in a specific act if they so specifically choose. And that is specific to the act. For example, I can more than welcome to invite someone to come celebrate Shabbat, can come celebrate Hanukkah, can come participate, just like someone can invite you to come celebrate your birthday. I also realized I didn't answer your question regarding my favorite superstition, and I do have those written down if you'd like to hear them.
Yeah, I okay. do.
Yeah.
I know I got off topic with the mud men and the vegetable mine. I'm sorry, the mud men and the mines. And Captain America. My favorite superstition is regarding our toilet demons.
Why? Okay, hold on. The reason I'm so floored, you're not the first person with a toilet demon.
Did you talk to Jihei?
Yeah. There's so many toilet.
There's so many toilet demons.
There's a Japanese toilet ghost. There's a.
Jihei, we had a conversation about a toilet goddess.
Oh.
And the toenail goblin.
Demon.
And now there's a toilet demon.
Yes. So we have very many demons within Judaism. In Judaism, it is believed that there are 1,000 demons to your left and to your right at all times. Demons are everywhere at all times. You're also supposed to not, you know, you should just leave your windows open just a crack, just to let the demons in and out, kind of like a cat door. That is a folk belief. There is a specific named demon who lives in your toilet. I'm not kidding. And it is also believed that you have angels that protect you. There are angels that are specifically for protection, and it is also believed that out of courtesy for your angels, for the angels, you should not ask them to protect you while you go to the restroom, because it's not courteous. But you can protect yourself from said toilet demon. The manner of protection from the toilet demon is unusual, I will say. It is not one that I ever thought I would ever have to consider. So it is believed to be a continuation of the Akkadian demon Shulak. So it's the demon Bar Shirik Panda, who's specifically named. And he's believed to be responsible for spreading plagues to mankind, right? Because toilets are obviously a very, they're a very dirty.
Yeah, cleanliness.
We're big on cleanliness. Keep clean. That's also why people accused us of, you know, spreading the plague, even though we had lower rates of the plague. But so there is something you can say. So according to Shabbat 67a, it states, to be saved from the demon of the bathroom, let him recite as follows. On the head of a lion and on the nose of a lioness, we found the demon named Bar Shirik HaPanda. With a bed of leeks, I felled him, and with the jaw of a donkey, I struck him. Now, as one would not ask their demons to come with them, it was believed that amulets would serve as protection during these rather exposed times. Alternatively, palpating the rectum, perhaps with a pebble or a stick, before defecating was thought to protect from demons. and it was done before sitting, not after. Though I must say I do not endorse this. I cannot logically or reasonably endorse
that behavior. So, question.
But I do love the superstition.
What? Stick? Does it have to be a specific kind of stick? That's the important
question. Not as discussed. Not as discussed. Though I'm shocked they didn't discuss that.
Well, because I'm thinking like you would want to use a very specific type of tree, maybe, or type of stick.
Just a clean one. Just I'm assuming they go clean. Not a poisonous one, probably.
So I guess I'm trying to think through like, because when I think through, Matt's fucking losing it.
I love that. I'm really glad this is eliciting some sort of reaction.
When I think about folklore, we always think that the folkloric demons, the superstitions, etc., they all happen for a reason, right? Like there's a belief, and bathroom demons usually have to do with cleanliness. So I'm thinking, how does the pebble help?
I'm guessing hemorrhoids. That's my guess, but I have no other guesses other than that.
Let me see. So,
are hemorrhoids tapeworms caused by the toilet demon?
No, it's not stated. So here's the thing. So we have to consider that in Judaism, we have a sort of closed ecosystem when it comes to what do demons do. Demons can cause any manner of things. Demons, while typically seen as harmful, do have the capacity for neutrality and even positivity. Demons have quite a large scale of, they have quite a big capacity, and unlike angels, they do not have a specific purpose unless specifically named, and they don't have instructions, and they do have a mind of their own. So demons can make decisions. So they can kind of do mostly whatever.
So what you're telling me is the toilet demon can literally do whatever he wants. If you
he usually spreads plagues, but also sorcery and witchcraft, which usually refers to the evil eye, but also any sort of negativity that might befall one, including sickness. Now, hemorrhoids being a sickness could be believed, or usually part of a sickness, could probably be seen as within the scope of a toilet demon. I'm so sorry. I hope Matt's okay.
Matt's like never okay.
Now, what?
So there's that, but it's also that if you've eliminated all the other quote-unquote possibilities of problems in your life, you have to keep going to the bathroom. If you've stopped interacting with all the other things that could cause you harm in your life, and you still have bad luck within Judaism, and you keep doing all the good things that you do in your life, right? You follow all the superstitions, you've done all the things that would remove evil eye, do all sorts of things, and the only thing left in your life is the toilet demon.
Okay, so it sounds like a suppository thing.
I don't think you're putting it in. You're just supposed to palpate. And again, I'm not instructing, and I'm not condoning or in any way recommending these cures.
I'm trying to sit here thinking, like, logistically, right? So you're having a
shit time. If it makes you feel better.
Time.
It makes you feel better. There is something you can do if you forget to do this. If you forget to use a pebble or a... It's suggested. It says pebbling perhaps with a stick or a pebble. So maybe there's something else they're using. I don't know. I've never done this.
Do you use your... I'm continuing.
I don't know. You know, frankly, this is not a practical solution for anyone, really. But you can say... You can say, not for me, not for me, not for tachtim, nor tachtim, which literally translates to bottoms. Not for these, nor any part of these, neither the sorceries of sorcerers, nor the sorceries of sorceresses. So you can just say that after you're done, and forget the palpation altogether.
So why does it even recommend the palpation?
Well, this is in case you forget, right? The palpation is apparently better. Again, the medieval ages really brought us to some new and trying times.
This is so good, so terrible all at one time.
This is going to be...
Jewish folk magic is wide, extensive, and very filled with random things.
I don't mean to laugh, but I do.
It's fine. You can laugh. I mean, this is...
this is like...
People
the toilet
always
demon is not for bottoms, though, you guys.
It always makes me laugh when people tell me that there's no folk magic in Judaism. We don't do that.
Toilet demons?
You guys are trying to exercise a toilet demon.
I have cried a little bit. To wrap up while Matt's dying, I was going to ask if you had any final thoughts.
To maybe make you feel better about the toilet demons, I do want you to know that there's a belief that there are angels for every little thing in the universe, including an angel that is helping every grass blade of grass grow. There's an angel for every loaf of bread that is being baked.
I love that.
An angel for every candle that is being lit. And I just think that's lovely.
Okay.
For every that means that there's an angel for the toilet as well.
That is what I was about to say. You
know what? Actually,
for every time you go to the bathroom.
So actually, because you're not supposed to ask your angels to go into the restroom with you, I don't know about the propriety of that experience. I would have to do some research on that and talk and do a little bit more research and find out.
I would like
I did talk about toilets a lot more than I thought I would in this episode,
frankly. Yeah, no, but it's okay. We always, it was gnomes and toilets.
No. Fuck gnomes.
No, I was gonna mention like cool things like writing with honey on like sage leaves and eating it for love magic, but I guess the toilet demons won out.
Look, if I could be honest, we get plenty of love magic around here.
We get plenty of love magic. We want to know more about bathroom entities. That's our favorite thing.
Oh, we could
talk
about.
I'm so glad that I could supply this.
I think it's called the Dumagoi. It's a bathroom demon.
Oh, Domovoi. It's Slavic.
Yeah.
Isn't the Domovoi the house?
Nope, Domovoi is
he's
the
a
bathhouse demon.
He's a bathhouse demon, but he can exist in your bathroom as well. Oh, did he go elsewhere?
He also in Judaism?
He's ended up everywhere. Bullshit.
That's insane. Italy doesn't have bathroom entities.
Y'all got shit to do.
If we do, I don't know about them.
Left alone and undisturbed, demons lived peaceably among humans as just another element of the local landscape. Jewish folklore is full of tales of benevolent guardian spirits akin to the Slavic Domovoi, the ancestral protective spirit or deity of a house. One typical example was the Lantuch, a creature with a long tongue and chicken feet, known for its mischievous tricks. It would sit in the synagogue and do penance for its sins on Yom Kippur, but it was also fond of copulating with women. I knew I saw it in this book. That's
it's
just a Jewish one for fun.
A chicken foot hoe.
A lot of our demons have chicken feet.
Foot hoe. Good to know.
Yeah, it's got a really long tongue and it likes to sleep with women.
I mean, it's got a really long tongue. I could see where it makes sense.
It's relatable.
Yeah.
Most relatable demon award goes to chicken foot.
Yeah, we've got a lot of really fun ones.
I love
but it's interesting
because so
this one.
And what book is that? Because now I gotta read about it.
This is the really good book that I mentioned earlier, A Frog Under the Tongue, Jewish Folk Medicine in Eastern Europe.
Well, I think it's interesting, and I would love to have another, like, we have, I think, three other topics we want to talk with you about. Not on our list somewhere.
More time with Zoe.
More time
with show up with my
more
stack
time
of
with,
books.
Jew witches. And then, final thoughts? Well, we talked about the angels. Matt, do you have any final thoughts?
Fuck gnomes.
This has been Books and Broomsticks. I'm Chaotic Witch Hunt.
I'm Matt Hatter Plays.
Say your name, Jew Witches.
And I'm Jew Witches.
And we will talk to you guys next week.